in these two modes, one of which will be just define, you know, give the definitions of what these things are so you can see what the properties are just in general, so what these various kinds of effective actions are. And then I want to calculate explicitly with this toy model as an example at various cases so you can kind of see how it's playing out. And so let me, since you've seen the toy model, before actually calculating anything in the toy model, let me just start with the definitions that we're going to want to take we're going to want to illustrate. So let me remind you of, so the first thing I'm going to say, and so here I'm going to talk about the one LPI, and the Wilson. So let me start with this. These are things that are to do with this having a light, having a hierarchy of scales and distinguishing light from heavy. But this is something which you would have talked about anyway. So this is the kind of, I just want to remind you how this worked in a field theory if you didn't care about hierarchies of scale. So this is just a reminder of a general formulation. So in principle, you could have the conversation about about low versus high energies using any particular observable you wanted to use. And since I want to emphasize that this applies to everything, that you're not restricted in the choices you make for your observables, I'd like to phrase it all in terms of this one particle irreducible generator, because the idea is that anything you want to calculate, you can ultimately get from correlation functions. So what we'll do is we'll calculate the generating function null for all the correlation functions of the fields in the problem and talk about it. And then any application you have will be a special case of that. And so in particular, any S matrix element you could get from the Green's functions if you wanted to, but kind of everything's in there. And so so what we'll start with is we'll consider the generating functional for correlations. So we're interested in correlation functions, which would be in the ground state, you calculate that some time-ordered product, and you know, strictly speaking, it's not exactly time-ordered, but we can talk about that. A bunch of fields, phi x, say x1 to xn. And I guess you'd want to, you normally would assume that omega is normalized. That's some state. So the way to define the generating functional would be that you define, I guess the straightforward thing you define would be if you define z as a function of j, so some function j of x to be some path integral. Step I forgot. How would you calculate correlation function in a path integral? In a path integral, representation, a correlation function like this would be, you should recall that that just the vacuum to vacuum amplitude would have been, if I calculated the integral over all the fields of e to the I action with some boundary conditions, I guess I should step back even one. If I took a field eigenstate, so phi of x, some other phi twiddle of y, so I took two specific fields, and I imagined looking for states which were eigenstates of the field operator. So these are like if we had been doing quantum mechanics, I took the position operator and I looked for position and basis in position space, and this would be the eigenvalue of that state. And for field operators, I could do the same kind of thing. I could imagine calculating the states that diagonalize the field operator. And the eigenvalue, curly phi, I'm using it to denote the eigenvalue of that of this operator in the state. Then the, you know, the party line on path integrals, which I'm just going to state, and I'll ask you at the end who's happy with it, and we can come back to it later. I integrate over all paths, all fields phi, which start at the remote past, you know, with the first configuration, phi twiddle, and they end in the future at 5x, weighted by the action. The claim is that that's giving me the, this is the I can call this like phi, say the in eigenstate and the out eigenstate. So I've evolved these things. It's a matrix element of the time evolution operator from the remote past between these particular field eigenstates. There's a, who's happy with that? Is anyone going to be unhappy if I start using the path integral to calculate, you know, Feynman rules or something like that? Okay. So then if I wanted the vacuum to vacuum amplitude, which is what I would typically do, I should slap the wave functional of the vacuum on both sides and then integrate over the initial and final values of the fields, right? So instead of having this boundary condition that I integrate between these two things, I would have the wave functional of the vacuum. But the wave functional of the vacuum in perturbation theory is a Gaussian, basically. And so there's a story that people tell where you can trade that basically for the I epsilon prescription. Whenever you calculate a Green's function here, when you use the Feynman propagator and you use the I epsilon prescription, you can think of that I epsilon as having come from the wave functional of the vacuum. So there's a formulation in which that I'm imagining using where the vacuum to vacuum adiabatic, so the matrix elements in the vacuum of the time evolution operator from the remote past to the remote future is given by this path integral, and the boundary condition issue I'm finessing by saying that we had put in the vacuum wave functional, and that through a long story that you've probably seen before turns into the I epsilon prescription for the propagators in field theory. Imagine that's all true. That's another story, but it's not one that that I need to tell you, because what I want to do is just go from here to here. The statement for how you'd calculate, if you repeated, you know, the way you derive this would be that you'd start off with your initial state in the past, and then you'd evolve it forward to some field configuration at some particular time. And you put a complete set of states in it everywhere at a whole bunch of different times, T prime, and so on until you got to your final state. And then you'd integrate over all these. You'd be putting a partition of unitary everywhere where you're integrating over a basis of states that are field eigenstates. And in between, from one time to the next time, you'd have to put in an e to the minus I Hamiltonian, you know, T minus T prime. And if you're careful about how you do this, then this turns into the matrix. The more precise way to do this would be to go from momentum position to momentum eigenstates repeatedly, and the position to momentum overlap becomes something like e to the I phi dot canonical momentum, and the Hamiltonian is the thing that evolves you in time, and so then that turns into a Lagrangian, and you end up getting an action, and hey presto, this integral over all possible field configurations in between becomes your path integral, and that's the story you tell when you're driving the path integral. And I told you that story to tell you this story, because if you now wanted to insert a bunch of fields, all you really do is you just stick. So if I wanted to calculate a correlation function for fields, time ordered, it's the same thing where I just have to, I weight the integrand by those fields. And the way you derive this would be the same argument. If I had inserted a complete set of states everywhere in here, and I integrated over a complete set for all a whole bunch of time slices that were closely spaced, as long as I chose n of them to sit at where these field operators are, I could repeat the argument verbatim, and I'd at one point convert the field operator into its eigenvalue, because it's going to hit a state which is the eigenvalue of the field. It would turn into just something sitting inside the integrand here, and you do that integral and turn the crank, and the same arguments would tell you that this matrix element, this correlation function, would have been is this path integral with the fields explicitly in the integrand. And the slippery bit is the time ordering. which I won't talk about because it's slippery, but it's basically it's all true. And the star here is just a technical thing.
Fields that you're putting tangible there, are they the operator fields? Or
no, the right hand side is an integral, so it's just those are just functions.
Okay, because you're writing them as you are writing your operators.
Yeah,
before.
That's right. I won't talk about operators very often, so let me just put hats on them. Okay. And the reason that I told you that is that if you really want to know all those things, a faster way of doing this would be, if you instead of calculating this, if you calculated an
exponential of e to the I field times some other function, we could just differentiate this thing with respect to that other function over and over again and pull down these powers and get any possible correlation function we want. So the generating functional would be define, say, z of j to be the integral over all the fields, the same kind of boundary condition story as over there, of e to the I action, it's a function of phi, but we'll add to the action a piece which is I the integral of j of x, I of x, d4x. And then this is a generating functional in the sense that if we take, you know, dz dj, then that will pull down one factor of that integrand. So I have an integral d phi e to the I action I the integral of j times phi d4x. But then I'll have differentiated once, and so I'll have a factor of I. And if I did it, you know, n times, then so I can count that n. Then I'll get I to the n, and I'll get phi to the x1, phi to the xn. So you can see this is the kind of thing that if I differentiate it, if I knew it as a functional of j, I could differentiate it as, repeatedly. And if I wanted if I really want this, I'd want to evaluate the answer at j equals 0 to kill that term, and I'd literally have the thing I was trying to do when I was calculating these correlation functions. So if you know delta to the n of z, delta j of x1, delta j of xn, evaluated at j equals 0, that's your correlation function. If I call these things g. Times, I guess, minus I to the n. So this is something, if we knew how to, figure it out what it was, then we could calculate whatever we want. Now, people normally, instead of talking about z, they talk about the logarithm of z. And the reason for that is that if you had calculated, let me make sure I say this right. If you had calculated the, in perturbation theory, if you'd taken this action and you'd written it as being a quadratic part plus fluctuations, and then the fluctuation, the cubic and higher pieces, and then you took the cubic pieces and you wrote them in a perturbative series, so you're always doing Gaussian integrals, that's the perturbation story in path integrals. And the Gaussian integrals where you have the action being quadratic in phi, you can do these integrals. And in that case, the integrals weighted by powers of phi just become the propagators that you're used to when you calculate Green's functions with Feynman rules. It's the thing that's appearing in a correlation function with two of these fields would have been just the inverse of whatever the operator was that's appearing in this action. So the functional, you know, if you remember the formula, the integral dx from minus infinity to infinity of e to the minus 1/2 lambda x squared, is, you know, the square root of 2 pi over lambda or something like that. You know, the thing that you're picking in the answer is 1 over the square root of the thing that was in your integrand. So if you multiply by I, it's actually still true, it turns out. If you make this an I, there's an e to the I pi by 4 or something like that. That integral converges. But if you do now an infinite number of times, then you get a product of these things, and that's more or less what your Green's function would have been. The thing that's appearing as your Green's function is the related to the inverse of the operator, the thing that's appearing in your action. And the analog of lambda is going to be something like box or something when you write an action out. And so when you derive the Feynman rules, you're using the properties of Gaussian integrals as applied to these quantities and you're probably happy with that already, so you're probably beating a dead horse. In that picture, the rule here would have been we just calculate Feynman graphs where, if we want to calculate this, we calculate Feynman graphs where J is, there's a vertex which has a field coming out and ending at J. And so you'd calculate all possible Feynman graphs which have, if I call the Feynman rule for this, a line ending, and I'll put an X there to represent J, because J is a specified function that you're calculating this as a functional of, then this would be some graph which is built out of all possible vertices. So you might have had a cubic term in your action somewhere as an interaction, and maybe you have a quartic term as well. And then there might be a bunch of J's at the ends of these lines. The lines terminate on J's, and otherwise they're just participating in there might be some loop in there. There'd be the expansion of the interaction terms in this action and the power series with the Gaussian integral done amounts to the sum, the Feynman rules, which is the sum over all these graphs where each line means the propagator obtained by inverting the quadratic part of the action, and the vertices are all the things coming in the nonlinear parts, the non-cubic and higher parts of the action. That's an algorithm for evaluating these. It's essentially summarized, it's a mnemonic for summarizing what you get when you do this Gaussian integral. And the mnemonic and the answer for this particular integral is the sum over all the graphs with these external lines labeled by J. I told you that because the difference, that would be telling you what this exponential e to the iw is, or what I called z before. When you take the logarithm, and so if you want to calculate what w was, if you take the logarithm of this thing I just told you, the rule in terms of graphs is a simple rule. It just, here we would have included graphs which were disconnected. So the one of the graphs which has a total of 10 powers of j in it could have been this graph which has 5 times another graph which has 5, say. This whole thing is one of the graphs that would have contributed in this path integral. Nothing says that the graphs have to be connected. But when you take the logarithm of this algorithm, you'll see that what you go through is you systematically go and remove all the disconnected graphs. And so the reason that w is a useful thing to talk about is that the graphical statement for how you calculate w is to sum all these graphs but keep only the connected graphs. And that's all you've done by taking the logarithm. So the bottom line is that in perturbation theory, where you write the action is the quadratic part plus the cubic and higher, so interaction part, or S quadratic is the integral d4x of phi, some operator phi. And you take e to the I interaction part, and you write it as being 1 plus I interaction part plus I squared over 2 factorial interaction part squared, and so on in the path integral. The Gaussian integral you get, gives z of phi, z of j, as sum of Feynman graphs where the lines correspond to a factor of delta inverse, where delta is the thing that was occurring in the action, in usual way. And w of j, defined to be minus I log of z, is sum of connected graphs, and it's with the same rules. And that's not quite right. I should actually make that more precise. A more precise statement is that in this Gaussian integral, if you write e to the I w of j as being integral d phi of e to the I s, well, let me do one more step and I'll do what I was going to say. So far, so good. So I haven't told you anything you didn't know already, I think. It's just this is a thing you could calculate. it has a, if you knew what it was, you could get all the Green's functions, you'd calculate it by summing graphs, and you know how to sum graphs. So now the, but so far, nobody's told you about effective action yet. So what's the effective action? So we'll define the effective action, gamma phi, as follows. And this is the 1pi effective action. We'll just define it to be the Legendre transform of W. So we'll define, so the argument here is not J, it's phi. And so phi is what you might think it is. It's supposed to be the expectation value of the operator phi. So if phi will be the integral d phi of e phi. Let me write it in terms of W. So if I differentiate W, dW, dJ. If I go back to this path integral, what happens when I differentiate? I pull down J, I pull down a factor of phi with a factor of I, but I also get a factor of I here if I differentiate this thing. So this would be the integral d phi of e to the I action, this function of phi, plus I, the integral of J times phi, before x. Times 5x. But then I have a factor of e. If I differentiate this whole thing, I've just told you what the right-hand side would have been up to a factor of I. But on the left-hand side, I've got I times the derivative of w times this exponential again. So I can divide by the exponential, and I'll write it as a path integral. The i's cancel. So that's what this is. And this is what I mean by curly phi. So this was, if you like, it was what I call the expectation value of phi divided by 1. So it's kind of what you would morally think of as being the quantum average of the field phi, although it's the in remote past vacuum and the remote future vacuum, which needn't be the same in general. So you should keep that in mind. If you're in a time-dependent background, that could be make a difference. So that's what phi is. And so what I'll define is gamma will be defined to be w. So like this tells me what phi is as a function of j. So I'll call it phi sub j just to emphasize that. And you can imagine inverting that function, and we'll assume that it is invertible. And you can normally invert it near a field point, but it's not clear that you can invert it everywhere. But in perturbation theory, you're only interested in a small range in field space. So that would give us J as a function of phi. And then the way we define gamma is gamma of phi is defined to be W evaluated as a function of J as a function of phi in the defined that way. I always get the sign wrong. Minus I integral J of phi. E beyond gamma. Actually, I think plus. If I get this wrong, I'll come back and fix it. So this has the property. It sounds bizarre. Why would you want to do this? This has the Legendre transform property. So this is, I should say that.
Legendre transform.
J. And the property is if I take delta gamma, delta J, I differentiate, then using the chain rule, I would have had the integral d4, this is a function of x, so integral d4y of delta W, delta J of y times delta J of y times delta phi of x plus phi. Bless you. Same thing here. I'd have the integral d4 y of delta j, y delta phi of x times phi of y. And I'll also get delta of x minus y if I differentiate that. So I say plus j of x. So I probably wanted a minus sign there. So the point of this is that we know how to calculate some of these things. No, what did I do wrong? I was trying to evaluate this. The argument, this thing depends on phi. I just want to differentiate it is all I want to do. So I think I got this part right, but I wrote the left-hand side wrong. So I use the chain rule here. W normally comes as a function of j, but I'm thinking j is a function of phi, so I do the chain rule. And then here, I've got j explicitly, so I just differentiate it. And I differentiate phi, and I get j. So now if I've done this right, dw dj was phi. So that's why I wanted the minus sign here, because now dw dj and phi, these are the same thing. And this is a common factor. So what's happened is that this now cancels that. So this is just equal to minus j. Because delta w delta j is equal to phi. So it's a Legendre transform in the sense that if I differentiate w with respect to j, I get phi. I do the same thing, differentiate this with phi, I get minus j. It's up to a sign. And this is kind of very much like that equation is very much like the classical field equation. You know, our original, the thing in the path integral was the s of phi plus the integral of j times phi d for x. Right? That was what was appearing in the path integral. If I call that s effective, then the equation of motion for phi would have been delta s, delta phi, you know, delta s effective. Delta phi equals 0 would have been the equation of motion. And that would have been delta s delta phi plus j is equal to 0. And what I've just shown you there is that gamma satisfies compare with, we just saw that delta gamma delta phi plus j is equal to 0. So for example, if you were interested in minimizing a field and its potential energy to see what its value should be, say, supposing the way you're going to determine phi is to solve the classical equations of motion by minimizing potential, say, then you would have been solving something like this. This would be saying in the full quantum theory, because gamma includes all the path integral stuff, the analog of the statement for phi would have been that gamma is the thing you would minimize. It's playing the role of the classical action as far as figuring out what the quantum effective expectation value of phi is. It's doing for the expectation value of phi what the classical action did for the classical field phi. And in particular, if I'm interested ultimately in the world where j is equal to 0, because I thought j, I just took j in as a trick to be able to generate Green's functions. So when j equals 0, which is the case of physical interest, I'm asking phi to satisfy delta gamma delta phi equals 0, is what determines phi. What happens when, what phi does when j is equal to 0 is it satisfies that, which is like the classical equation of motion for the classical fields, phi. So it has an intuitive feeling as it's the kind of thing that gamma is like the classical action that includes all the quantum corrections, if you like. And there's limits to how well you can do this. If you're doing a time-dependent problem, if you're careful about this, this statement would be the adiabatic statement. If you're changing things slowly enough that in the quantum system, the state you're looking at is adiabatically evolving, then this will capture its behavior. Typically, but if you have some random time variation where things are happening quickly, then this won't actually capture the behavior of the state you're looking at. But there's a sense in which it's like the classical action, but including the quantum effects. Right. So that's interesting in itself, but how do you calculate it? So we had a Feynman rule way of calculating what W was. There should be a corresponding Feynman rule way of calculating what gamma is. And that's where the name comes from, this 1PI effective action. So the way to work that out is we know that e to the I gamma of phi plus e to the I W of j minus I the integral of j times phi d for x. And this was the thing that was the path integral. So I can just write this as the integral d phi of e to the I classical action w of j had within it plus I the integral of j times phi d4x. And now I'm going to subtract off this thing. Nothing here depends on the thing I'm path integrating over, right? This phi was something which was something I would calculate. It's a one-point function. J was something which is specified, and phi is a function of j, if you like. So these are just some things that depend on the data we're specifying, and they're not the thing I'm integrating over. That's why it's a curly phi, and that's not a curly phi. So I can stick it inside the path integral for free here. So I got minus phi minus curly phi before x. So it's irresistible to change variables to, let's call that psi, or let's call that, capital phi or something. And that's a shift, so I can change the integration variables and there's no Jacobian. So we'll have integral d capital phi e to the I action of curly phi plus capital phi plus I integral of j times curly phi d4x. So what we've done, basically the only difference here between this and w is that we've got a background field phi, which is specified. That's the thing that's the argument of gamma. I'm doing an integral over all possible configurations that are deviations from that background field, but I've coupled a current to that fluctuation. Whereas before I was coupling a current to the whole field. That's all that's happening. Really. So that's nice as far as it goes. It looks like it's a very complicated formula to use because in principle, I'm supposed to think of, I specify phi, j here is implicitly a function of phi because remember j and phi are related to each other and I could calculate it once I had, if I knew what gamma was, I could differentiate it and that would be minus j and that would be telling what j is a function of phi. So you can think of this as gamma's appearing here as minus d gamma d phi as well as here. So it doesn't look like the most useful formula for calculating gamma, but the reason it's useful is that in perturbation theory, the statement of what this is in graphs is really simple. So in perturbation theory, what's happening is, you know, we already knew that as thought of as graphs, this was the sum I should say this, there's two things. I should first confess that I lied to you a little bit before, and then, so let's just write this out. So what is this? This is going to be, so S of phi plus capital phi. What I should be doing in perturbation theory is expanding around whatever, this is the analog of the vacuum value for phi. It's the expectation value. It's what V was in our example. And this is the thing that's like the quantum field or the fluctuation. And so I should be expanding in powers of this phi. And I'll keep the quadratic pieces in the action, and then anything that's cubic and higher, I'll treat perturbatively. So I'll write this as being S as a function of phi. There could be a linear piece, which I'll just call S prime as a function of phi times phi. And this is code for, you know, what this really means is the integral d4y of delta S delta phi of y times capital phi of y. I just don't want to write these integrals all the time. That's what that's supposed to mean. And then it'd be in the second term of the Taylor expansion would be 1/2 s prime prime of phi times phi squared. And again, this is really an integral over y, an integral over z of the second derivative of s with respect to phi of z and five x and five z times capital phi of x and capital phi of z. So this thing here is an operator. It'll be might be box or something in your theory. And then there'll be cubic and higher terms. So if I put this in this path integral to get a perturbative expression, then what I'm going to get is e to the I gamma of phi will be, the classical piece here doesn't depend on the integration variable, so I can pull it out. So it'll be an e to the I classical action of phi times integral d phi of the thing that's linear in phi. There's a piece from here, but there's also a piece from here, right? So we'll get e to the I the integral d4x of delta d5x minus jx. So I've taken this piece here, the linear term in the expansion, and the explicit current term, and this should have been d5x. And then I've got the quadratic piece, I over 2 s prime prime of phi plus phi squared, which is really some complicated thing involving, you know, boxes. And then I've got the perturbation in all the, you know, the cubic stuff. So plus 1 over 2 factorial cubic stuff squared, and the expansion of the exponential of the interactions. And so this is now a bunch of Gaussian integrals. What I do is now you remember I'm supposed to think of J as satisfying minus d gamma d phi. So this says that the first approximation to gamma will be that gamma is equal to S. So gamma will be equal to S. That's this term. The second approximation will be, well, when that's true, if I use gamma is equal to S, then this term is going to drop out. And the next term will be just this Gaussian integral where I drop all the interactions. So the next term will be the one loop piece, which is, let me call it gamma one loop. And gamma one loop will be, you know, the determinant of S prime prime to the minus 1/2. So it's some mess. You have to figure it out. It's the thing you get when you do the Gaussian integral with nothing else in the integrand. And then the correction to that will be where the graphs start. So I'll have this involve powers of phi. And when I do a Gaussian integral with powers of phi in it, then I end up with inverses of this operator. And that's the Feynman rules that you normally calculate. So I get sum of and they all have at least two loops in them. So two loop and higher graphs. And some of those Feynman rules in those graphs involve this linear piece here, right? Because this was something which was, this only vanishes in the approximation that gamma is equal to S, but that's actually not exactly true. That was only true of the linear order. So this is, you'll have graphs which will involve all kinds of things, and they'll have external lines. Instead of having just J as an external line, we're going to get this bizarre combination of J minus ds d gamma. So I can think of that as being d gamma. I'm surprised at the sign here. Did I get the sign wrong? Yeah, I got the sign wrong. Plus. This is the ds d phi minus d gamma d phi. So what's appearing on these external lines that stop is this thing. And that's something which is the difference between the derivative of gamma with respect to phi and the derivative of the classical action. So it's stuff which is loops or smaller. And the useful thing of this whole calculation is that it's these things are what make this doable. If you had to really know what this was, you'd be screwed. But what these things do is they just basically go through and they remove all the one-particle reducible graphs. So to see why that's true, you should think about. And we're out of time. No, we're not out of time. We started half past. I was having so much fun. That was over already. All right. So claim is these terms go through. Once we evaluate, if you did this for arbitrary values of J, what I was telling you would not be true. But when you choose J to satisfy this, so that condition there, which makes J a function of phi, goes through and lops off all these one-particle reducible graphs. So these terms, when evaluated at J equals minus d gamma d phi, cancel out all one-particle reducible graphs. So if you had some graph, with a line in it, so there's a bunch of stuff going on in here, I don't care what it is, had no external lines, because I happen to have no contributions from these J's, but you could break it into two by breaking one line. That's what it means to be one particle reducible. And you can make it disconnected by breaking one line, so that makes it one particle reducible. So it is one particle reducible if it becomes disconnected disconnected. When one line breaks. So why aren't these graphs there? It's because somewhere else in this series is there's this thing with an x on it. And if you think about how do you calculate this x, how do you calculate what this condition is here, what you would do is you'd calculate the condition that d gamma, you know, d gamma is the sum of these things. If I differentiate it, I'm going to pull out one of the fields, and so I'm going to have a dangling leg in these graphs. So d gamma d phi minus j is basically the sum of all graphs with one line sticking out in any particular order. And so you can kind of see that I'm lying to you. The way to think about these graphs is that this would have been. Let me write this out explicitly. This would have been let me treat separately things the Feynman rule where I have j here and where I have d gamma d s d phi here. Because those are the two things that were actually appearing in this action. So this would be equal to the sum of things where I stick delta s delta phi, and I add to it the things where I stick j. And the condition that I make j satisfy that this is equal to zero, to every order in the loop expansion, because that's my definition of what phi does. This is an exact statement. This should be zero. Requiring this to be true order by order in the loop expansion is saying that the sum of all the graphs with one line coming out is exactly canceled by the sum of all graphs with a current on it, with one line coming out and ending at a current. And so that means that the total sum of the graphs with one line coming out for all possible reasons is vanishing. But that's what this is. So if you've imposed the condition that the tadpole graphs are vanishing, which is essentially what this condition is, it says that you're never going to get a line, you're never going to get a contribution from something which has got one internal line that you can break the whole graph with. So what's happening is that everywhere, if you just did the graphical expansion of this path integral for a random value of j or for phi, you would have gotten all these one particle of reducible graphs, but you would have also had graphs with external lines on them that corresponded to these j's. And when you chose the value of j as a function of phi that corresponds to this statement, the graphs which had currents on them go through and they systematically cancel all these graphs that were reducible. So the end statement is a really simple statement. You're supposed to sum all the Feynman graphs and just throw away all the ones that you can break with one line. And that's those, and so that's called the one-particle irreducible graphs. So the upshot is I'm probably beating this over the head because this is something you may have seen in a field theory course. And so who's happy with the statement of one-particle irreducible graphs? And so some of you have seen it, some of you haven't seen it, it looks like. So I'm not doing justice to it because this is kind of a whole topic in a field theory course, and I want to tell you this story to tell you another story, which is the effective field theory story. But it's the thing I'm about to say now is the important upshot, and there's an argument here that I'm alluding to. So the upshot, gamma is, if I rewrite this thing, it's a classical action plus this one loop thing, which is code for that determinant of the second derivative to the minus 1/2. Plus sum of two loop and higher, one particle irreducible graphs. So for example, and these now have no external lines because we've canceled them all by this condition. So for example, this would include, it's got to start with two loops, so it could include that graph. Include that graph, What else could it include? There's got to be more than just those two, right? It does not include this graph, because that's one particle reducible. You know, at three loop level, we'd have graphs like this, and so on. And so there's a very simple statement as to what you're doing here. And if you ask, how does the phi dependence come into this? Phi dependence is coming in because all these lines were coming from the inverse of this thing, but you've expanded your action around phi, and so that all your propagators are functions of the background you expanded around. So even though you're not keeping any external lines anymore, which is where the current used to come in, the answer knows about phi because of the fact that all your lines and all your vertices depend on phi, because you're expanding the action around that point in field space. So the bottom line is that there's a very simple perturbative expression for what this is. And in a semi-classical expansion, this starts off being the classical action. That fits with our picture that this thing looks like. The picture here was that this thing looks like the quantum corrected classical action. It's a thing that you extremize to find the quantum expectation value of the field. That sounds like a quantum version of the classical action. It's good that in the classical approximation, it starts off being the classical action. Then the next correction will be something which you have to calculate. Then after that, you start doing graphs. And this is often written as a circle. But if you actually did the Feynman rule of this, you will not get this. And so never, 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 never write this for this. But if you go to Bryce DeWitt's lectures, for instance, he writes this. And what he means is that this is code for this. And you're not supposed to parse this the same way you would parse any other Feynman graph. And so so you should not do that. OK. So it's a useful thing because it gives you correlation functions. If you know what gamma is, you can figure out what W is. You can figure out what the correlation functions are. If you wanted to calculate, in practice, what you really would do is you'd calculate the, if you, in a graphical language, ask, how do you take the vertices of gamma and make the full Green's function? Then what that amounts to is, the full Green's function is the sum of all the graphs. This is the sum of all the one-particle irreducible graphs. And the way you get all the graphs from the one-particle irreducible graphs is you string them together in tree graphs. So you take, if you took all the interactions for gamma and you differentiate it n times with respect to phi, and you use that to define new Feynman vertices, then if you took all the tree graphs with those vertices, you would get the full answer to all loops. And so in that sense, it's behaving like a classical action. And I haven't proven that, but it's something which it's true. All right, so that's something which is useful in a field theory in general. What about if you have two kinds of fields? So now suppose there is a hierarchy of masses. So we've got light fields, which are collectively denoted by L, but there could be many of them, and heavy fields. And so these have mass, little m, and these have mass, big M, where little m is much smaller than big M. And when I want to be concrete, I'll use that toy model I told you about this morning. What I'd like to do is now refine this definition a little bit, because if we have a hierarchy of the scales, and if we're assuming that we can never measure, or we're never interested in measuring observables that care about the high energy scale. So we're never going to have particles that are that energetic. We're never going to resolve distances that are as small as the wavelengths in the high energy sector. Then we're not interested in all observables. And in particular, gamma could have given us all observables, because you can evaluate it at any functional of phi that you like. So what I'd like to do is define an observable, an analog of gamma, which is just sufficient for calculating the low energy part of the observables. So the things that involve long wavelength or low energy observables, and not all of them. So if your interest is only in energies much less than capital M, or distances, say lambda, much bigger than 1 over m, then you don't need, you know, gamma is overkill. You don't need. Gamma of phi of x for all phi. So more precisely, we have kind of more than one kind of field here. So let's say for each field, I could have had a current. Let me do this on another board. So the analog of gamma in that case, if I have two fields, would be I put a couple of current to each of them. And if I differentiate with respect to those two currents, I could pull down correlation functions of all the fields. So gamma would have been defined as a function of I need a notation here now. Let me say these are the expectation values. Let me use L and H for the things I'm going to integrate over. And lowercase will be the things that they're like what was curly phi for the one field. So if I think of L of x, h of x, and I'd get this by, I could define it by, it would be W of, I don't know, little j of x and capital J of x minus the integral d4x of capital J times h plus little j times l. So I'm just repeating the definition of gamma as the Legendre transform of W, where W would have been e to the iw of j, and j would be some path integral over h and l, the fields, weighted by some classical action involving l and h, plus coupled to these things coupled to a current. So we have d4x. J times H plus J times L. So if I define this thing, I can differentiate with respect to J and little j. I'll pull down powers of H and L. I'll get correlation functions of all the fields, any ones I like. I can Legendre transform on both of these things to define a functional of two fields, which will be the, morally speaking, they'll be like the expectation values of these fields, H and L. And I'm defining them as the Legendre transform as it was before. I take W of J, and I think of J being a function of phi, because I'll ask that from this, I can see that that L will be dW dJ, and that H will be dW d capital J. So if I think of H and little l being defined in this way, then I can invert all that, and this definition now makes as much sense as the first one did involving one field. So this is just now repeating what I did before with two fields. So there's nothing new there. And again, this would be the sum of all the one particle irreducible graphs. This would be sum of all the connected graphs, blah, blah, blah. So gamma is classical action, function of L and H, plus some one loop thing, which will now be a 2x2 field space determinant, plus some vacuum graph, two loop and higher graphs. Now, if I never want to actually measure a low energy observable, then what I could do is I could say, you know, where I choose what my observables are is when I choose these currents, right? If I start off here, if I went to momentum space, the high frequency parts of this thing are getting paired off with the high frequency parts of J, and the low frequency parts are getting paired off with the low frequency parts. So if I want to look at only very slowly varying functions, if I never want to look at the heavy field at all, now, I only want to look at the light field, but only for short wavelength, long wavelength modes of the light field. So I don't want to look at energetic light particles. Then what I'm asking to do is to restrict how quickly J can vary in space. That's the long wavelength part of the light field. And I don't want to have J, capital J at all, because I never want to actually look at correlation functions of the heavy fields. So to specialize only to correlations of light fields, I should take capital J and I should set it equal to zero, because that was the J was there so I could differentiate it many times to get powers of H in correlation functions. But if I never want to do that, then I should go to the field, the system I started with, which didn't have any currents, and just set that current to zero. And to specialize only to correlations of long wavelength parts of L, I should require little j of x to only involve long wavelengths. So to make that more precise, what I should do is I should in practice, I could go to Fourier space, but in practice, in reality, what I should be doing is I should be taking the operator that's appearing in the quadratic part of the action, diagonalizing it, and asking about its eigenvalues. And when I say I want to be in long wavelength, I want to be in low values of those eigenvalues. But let me come back to that later on, and let me just say it now in terms of frequency. So in practice, what I would mean is that so if I wrote J of x as integral d4p 2 pi to the fourth e to the I px of J of p, what I would ask is that J of p equals 0 if, say, p squared plus lambda squared is bigger than, sorry, p squared is bigger than lambda squared. And I'll do this, if we did this in Lorentzian signature, this would be, I'd have negative energy squared plus momentum squared. So I'll do this in Euclidean signature. So I'll ask that that frequencies and momenta separately are bounded above by lambda. So where PE squared is energy squared plus momentum squared. So I'm just not going to allow this thing to vary quickly as a function of frequency or as a function of momentum. And so I'll have to quantify that somehow by specifying what's the shortest wavelength I'm prepared to talk about. And in practice, I'm thinking that lambda should be less than m, because otherwise I wouldn't have any, if I'm allowed to have very short wavelength pieces of J, so very high energy light particles, they could have produced through interactions the heavy particles I'm trying to ignore. So if I had lambda bigger than m, it wouldn't have been consistent to take capital J to be zero. So they have to come together, that if I'm going to not let J, capital J turn on, I should not allow myself to have sufficiently very, very short wavelengths of the light fields. So what difference does this make in the whole story of effective actions? You know, the role of J was to take, if I calculate the path integral for this action here now, if I calculate e to the I gamma of L and H, that was some path integral of dL dH, e to the I action of, same argument as before, is going to say that I should take L plus capital L, H plus capital H, plus I integral d4x of J times L or H, plus little j times L. This is what I would have had if I just calculated the full 1pi effective action for the full theory. But I'm specializing now to the case where capital J is 0. And the same thing's going to be true for, in this integral, if I wrote it in momentum space, for the momenta above some point, little j is going to be 0. And the important point of that is, so the, if I actually ask, how does that change the way I evaluate this thing? Remember what capital J was doing, it was the thing that was enforcing the statement that when I do these graphs, I only keep the ones, I throw away all the one particle reducible graphs. And in particular, I could have had graphs which were split by a heavy line, or I could have had graphs which were split by a light line. Those are two ways in which a graph could have been one particle reducible. And capital J was the thing that was canceling these things, and little j was the thing that was canceling these things. And so if I no longer, but the cancellation of these things was requiring that I choose J to be set to, so these are canceled if capital J is minus d gamma d h. So if I make this choice for J as a function of L and H, then I cancel all these graphs. And these graphs are all canceled if little j is minus d gamma d L. But if I set J equals 0, I'm not making this choice. And so what will happen when we calculate this thing with those choices for J is that I'm supposed to sum over all the vacuum graphs, but I'm not supposed to throw away the graphs that are one particle reducible if the line that I broke was a heavy line. So the choice that J is 0 is saying I keep these graphs now. And these graphs would be gone if I kept J arbitrary, little j arbitrary, but I'm also not allowing myself to have little j, I'm setting little j to be 0 effectively for high frequency pieces. So if this is being split by a light line where there's lots of momentum in here, then or lots of energy in here, that would be a problem too. In practice, for a vacuum graph, that won't happen unless you're doing something funny. But so the bottom line is that the difference, the effective action that you would get with this choice. So now H, I'm going to write this as being H bar, if you like. H bar was equal to delta gamma was equal to delta W delta J. At J equals 0. And so because of that, it satisfies that the effective action with respect, if I differentiate with respect to H, and I evaluate it at H bar, I get 0. Because you remember in the Legendre transform, wherever it is, the Legendre transform is designed so that this is true, and similarly, delta gamma delta L plus little j will be equal to delta gamma delta capital J, sorry, delta H plus capital J will be 0. So if I set capital J equals 0, then H is being forced to be the extremal point for gamma. So I can think of, I should be thinking of H here as not being something which I get to vary anymore. It's something which is fixed as a function of little l by making this thing stationary with respect to H. That's the expression for gamma of what it meant to say that capital J was 0. And the same thing's true for the high frequency part of little j, which is kind of less important in practice. And with that choice, this is the sum of all graphs. So let me call that to emphasize that that depends on L. So H bar is equal to H bar of L. So let me close with this final line. So the one light particle irreducible generator, which I'll call gamma of L, is just the full thing evaluated at L and at H bar as a function of L, where delta gamma delta H at H bar is equal to 0. That's equal to the classical action plus this one loop thing plus sum of one light particle irreducible vacuum graphs. And so that just means one particle irreducible, but only for light things. And you keep the one particle reducible graphs that were involving heavy lines. And so the point of these definitions is that if you want to know everything with the whole theory, then gamma is your guy. But if you're only interested in light degrees of freedom, then everything you ever wanted to calculate for light degrees of freedom only can be calculated using this little gamma. And its calculation is slightly different from the full gamma. And the main difference is that whereas if you had been calculating little gamma and thinking that it was really the full gamma, just where I chose not to look at H, the thing you would get wrong would be you'd be throwing away the heavy graphs which involve that can be broken with the exchange of one heavy state, which are really supposed to be kept in this thing. But this thing, once you have it, generates the Green's functions for light fields exactly the same way that gamma did, but it only does it for the fields that are going to be relevant at low energies. So this has all the information of the low energy theory. Which is lower G means below lambda, the thing I use to define where the currents stop varying, as opposed to capital gamma, which has all the information of the whole theory. So the next, that kind of summarizes the definitions. The next thing I want to do is to, so we want to calculate this thing. That's the goal, is to calculate this thing, but we want to do it in as efficient a way as possible. And so the idea is to take this path integral here. And we just do this integral. First, we do the integral over the very short wavelengths to your cutoff, whatever it was that you're defining a long wavelength theory in terms of. And then you do the integral from the cutoff to zero wavelength. And so by doing it in two pieces, we'll define the integral over the short wavelength stuff as being e to the I some action. That'll be the Wilson action. And it, by definition, will be the thing that you integrate over to get this one light particle irreducible thing. And so, I might as well, I'll do that next time. Any questions about that? Yeah.
Same as it was in the 1PI.
Which one is this one?
The one before. You said gamma 1 loop, is that unchanged? So it's still contained.
It's still the one with the term, or it's still the term that might as well have the operator list. But it's evaluated at this degree as far.
Okay.
Oh, Matt, don't class next week if you missed it. And the week after, I'm negotiating with someone whether or not we have the afternoon class, because someone wants to use this class. So far, we'll have a normal class 2 weeks from now, but there's a chance that the afternoon class may be canceled.